Blog Talk Radio.
We own this country.
We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Welcome to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. And I hope we get through it without any technical difficulties, because I'm telling you today, the technical gods, the electronic technical gods, have been pooping on me all day long. My internet was out most of the day. My phones were out off and on most of the day. Skype doesn't like me when I tried to call into Blog Talk Radio. I can't, so I'm hoping my phone doesn't go out, and I hope we don't lose connection here today. I've got my good buddy Dave is standing by helping me in case I have a technical crash here today. But generally, I think we have a pretty good show lined up for us. We've got a lot of things to cover. It's been a very busy week going through the election cycle. It's always a busy week. I spent most of Monday following around Todd Akin and Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was in St. Louis campaigning for Todd Akin, and that was very exciting, and it was a very good, I think, boost to the Akin campaign. And we'll talk to Ryan Height from the Akin campaign, and we'll get an update on how things are going with the campaign in general, the fundraising, the boosts to the campaign, because we've got a lot of people jumping on board now that were generally, some of them were naysayers before, trying to get Todd to jump off the race. We're going to have Bill Federer with us today. With everything that's blowing up in the Middle East, and with as asleep as we have been as Americans about the Islamic culture, and all of the things that it means to Americans, we're going to have Bill Federer on, and we're hoping that he can set us straight and give us some insight. I've heard Bill talk a couple of times now, and he's just an amazing wealth of knowledge. I don't think anybody has studied history the way that Bill Federer has, and he has just got more information than I can't imagine how anybody can cram that much information into one head, but he's got it, and we'll have him on with us in a little while. And something that we've been wanting to do here at Missouri Grassroots Radio for quite some time is to educate the folks on Agenda 21. And we're going to have Ray Cuneo. Again, Ray Cuneo, another wealth of knowledge on the Agenda 21 issue. We're going to hope to have Ray on a regular basis to give us, you know, pieces at a time to digest this very complicated issue. It's just so multilateral, dimensional, crazy, spreads its cancerous fingers into every aspect of the American culture and the American society, and it's invaded our government on the most local of levels. And Ray's going to be able, hopefully over time, to explain those kinds of things to us, and we'll have him on a little bit later. And we're going to also have an update on the St. Charles County police issue. And in true culture vigilante style, we're starting to get some action items together for people to take action on that situation. You know, you got to take control of it yourself, because if you sit back and wait for somebody else to do it, it's not going to happen. So we're going to take control of this issue ourselves, and we're going to turn it around as Americans and voters and citizens, and we're going to take action, and we'll have some information from the folks working on that campaign to help us do that. Right now, because I know he's very busy and I don't want to keep him waiting too long on the line, we have Ryan Height from the Todd Akin campaign. Ryan is the communications director for the campaign, and he has been running his legs off, I would imagine, over the last few days. I've been at several Todd Akin events in less than a week, and I think that Ryan has probably been a key part of putting those kinds of events together and making things run smoothly, and they've all run very smoothly. Last week I was at an event at Pillar in the Valley, Women Standing with Todd Akin, and there's an article up at examiner.com and at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org about that very event. Women have banded together to support Todd Akin and to let the Missouri community know that, we're not hung up on a misstatement. We're still supporting Todd because we know he's the best senator candidate in this race. And also, I posted another story just a couple of hours ago that is also up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org about the boost that Newt Gingrich has brought to Todd's campaign and all of the other Republicans who seem to be, after the 5 o'clock deadline of yesterday, have had a change of heart about how they're going to support Todd Akin. You know, I have some opinions about that. It's just too bad they couldn't have done it before the 5 o'clock deadline. We're happy to get their support regardless, but we're going to talk to Ryan about that. How are you doing tonight, Ryan?
I'm doing well, Lisa. How are you doing?
Well, I could be better if my electronics were working better, but otherwise I think I'm going to be okay.
I understand how that goes.
Yeah. Are you getting much sleep these days? Are they letting you sleep? It seems like there's just something going on constantly with the Akin campaign. What's going on?
Oh, an hour of sleep here, hour of sleep there, and you're fine after a little while. You just adjust to it. But we are, in fact, running our legs off around the state here, doing a true grassroots style campaigning, getting out, pounding the pavement, meeting people. And I tell you what, it has just been a pretty intense run since the primary, but we're excited and we are energized and ready to go because we are just meeting people across the state who are so encouraging and so supportive of Todd's bid for the Senate here. And then they're just looking forward to having someone with some common sense principles and values in his mind and in his heart when he goes off to D.C. So I'm sitting in Rolla right now, outside an event, and we've been running around central and southwest Missouri today.
That's excellent. When I'm sure Todd doesn't remember this, but I know I was there on the night of the primary election night, and I asked him shortly after he gave his acceptance speech, what part that he thought the grassroots movement would play in his campaign, and I don't think anybody could have known at the time just exactly how much this would have turned into a grassroots-style campaign. Nobody could have foreseen the events to come, but it really does seem like since the interview with Charles Jayco that this has really – the grassroots folks have just come out of the woodwork to support Todd in his campaign.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, really, it reminds me of another race in Missouri not too long ago, depending on what generation you are, but in 1940 when Harry Truman, the junior U.S. Senator, was running for election in 1940, he had a tendency to call things like he saw them in true Missouri show-me fashion, and he made some people mad in the Democratic Party system over in the cities in St. Louis and Kansas City at the time. And they told him in no uncertain terms that he wouldn't be making the election that year, that they were going to make sure of it. And he was not their first, second, or even possibly third choice. They said that we're done with you and we don't have anything to help with. So that sounds kind of familiar. But I'll tell you what, Harry Truman hired himself a driver, and for 6 weeks he piled around the state, shaking hands, meeting people, and just getting his message out there, and he won that seat. And I think it was that kind of tenacity and that attitude that probably helped his victory over Dewey in 1948, when even the polls were stopping polling because they just figured he was so far down. But sure enough, he came back in the presidency in 1948 and won re-election. So that's what we're doing. We're getting out there on the ground. Whatever the party heads are telling us, the Washington insiders on really both sides of the aisle, we just plugged through. And now that we're through the deadlines, it's just nice to be back in a happy party family, at least to the extent that we are, and have everyone unified. Because really, the main goal is making sure that Senator Claire McCaskill comes back home to Missouri and stays here starting in January, because her votes and her ideas and the things that she's tried to push through in the Senate have just done nothing but harm our jobs, our economy, and really just put Missourians out of work and out of money, and that has to stop.
Absolutely. Well, okay, Ryan, let's talk a little bit about the change of heart that seems to be coming about in the Republican establishment GOP. Today I posted a story at examiner.com, and in that story I reported that Jim DeMint and Rick Santorum mm-hmm. both issued a joint statement today in support of Todd, and the senator from the other senator from Missouri, Roy Blunt, who had been a vocal detractor from Todd's campaign in the past, has also turned around and endorsed Todd or thrown his support behind Todd. Do we have any information on anybody else who might be looking this way to support Todd?
Well, you know, I'm sure we're going to be seeing a lot of people pile in behind us and get behind this effort and this campaign. And, I'm not sure of any names. I can't think of any that I've heard, any prominent names that are going to be coming behind us quite yet. But I'm sure we'll be hearing from some. But, there were a lot of people who were kind of skeptical of this whole thing. They're entitled to their opinion, and we were very respectfully grateful that they shared that with us. But when we stayed in and when we made that decision 4 weeks ago or so, when everyone asked us, how's this going to work? How's this going to work if everyone's against you and your own side? We told people, and it, held true that, hey, look, when it comes down to it, when we stay through these deadlines, there's really no reason why everyone shouldn't come back over because, there's a clear choice between Claire McCaskill and Todd Akin. And, most of these people that were suggesting or asking that we step down, up to and including Senator Blunt, they're not going to go out there November 6th and vote for Senator McCaskill, that's for sure. They just don't agree with her on issues. So, I think we're going to be seeing pretty much everybody come back on board. And even today, they didn't express their support, but even today, some of the most vocal opponents to our candidacy, the National Senatorial Republican Committee, even there, they put out a statement today saying that they were just assessing and watching from a distance the Akin campaign to see what happened. Because obviously to any, people who like limited government, Todd Akin is a much preferred choice over Claire McCaskill. So they didn't, pledge support or money, but their tune has even changed from last week. So now that we're down to the choice, I think we're going to be seeing a lot of people, a lot of big names, and who you would usually think would get behind the conservative. I think you're going to start seeing them coming out and going to bat for
sure.
Us.
Well, I know that Todd has been doing a pretty good job of raising money. I think the grassroots, right after the statement happened, the grassroots, he raised quite a bit of money in very tiny, small donations from a lot of people in the grassroots. And just last week, earlier on Monday, when Newt came in and he hosted a $500 plate luncheon, which was well attended, and you had a fundraiser today, which was well attended. So the money is starting to roll in a little bit here and there, right?
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. As soon as this whole thing happened about 4 weeks ago, I guess the 20th and 21st were the two. Two really tough days there. I think the 21st, if I remember correctly, was the first 5 p.m. deadline. We started getting an outpouring of support from really across the country. I remember seeing donations coming in online from everywhere from California to Texas to Maine. And, people across the country saw what was happening, not really from the left and from the Democratic Party, but from our own party. And they stood in there and said, hey, look, there was an election, and the people of Missouri voted, and it wasn't even really that close. A 6-point margin, in a 3-way is a pretty big deal. So they elected you, and that doesn't mean that someone has the right to, whatever party they are, go around and try to move pieces like a chessboard. And a lot of people started pitching in there, $5, $10, $15, and, after a while you start noticing a trend of $50 and $100 and $250. So, it didn't. I don't know if it was able to reach national campaign levels, but we saw an incredible amount of money pouring in. People walking in the office, donating online, and I don't know. That alone certainly can't add up to the millions that Claire McCaskill is going to throw at us. But when that starts going at a decent rate, there's a lot of money that people are willing to sacrifice from the smaller grassroots contributions. And when those people are willing to get behind you, that's votes in Missouri. When someone's willing to write you a $50 check, they're more than likely in a position where that hurts. That means they're giving something up. Everyone talks about how the big donors are going to come back in. And, we appreciate everyone and everyone's financial contribution. They're all important, and they all get us toward the goal. But there are a lot of people who I saw coming into our office that week of this controversy that were giving us $20 and $50. And I knew that this was something they were giving up a potential luxury or even something they're used to support Todd. And that's a really moving experience. And it's something that I think really is motivating some of those people at the top levels and the different things and the parties and some of the, you know, bigger names that have come on board with us, because they see that and they know that they've got a real candidate and a real campaign and people who are going to come out and support, because they are very loyal to Todd.
But we don't want to discourage, you know, we don't want to discourage people, from, you know, from continuing to support Todd financially, because he does need that money.
Absolutely not.
We really need.
No,
we need people to contact the NRSC and put pressure on them, because that's where the real money is, because Claire is going to outspend Todd 10-1 on television ads for sure. And
I tell you what, ads. Yeah, I was gonna say, as much as the you know, money isn't everything, it sure helps. And she's got that war chest put together by a bunch of union people and a bunch of, you know, union leaders and bosses and party people, and they're gonna come after us with a vengeance. So we're gonna need everything we can get, and that doesn't end. So, you know, everyone, I encourage Aiken.org, if you can, you know, help and pitch in a little bit, you know, we're going to need it all the way up through. And if you can call the RNC and the NRSC and let them know that you're supporting Aiken and that you're going to make sure we win this race and we need their money, you know, those calls are welcome, and we would encourage everyone to do that. Let them know who the People's Choice is in Missouri and that we want Claire McCaskill to retire this January.
Absolutely. So we actually, I think we need to start a campaign here at Missouri Grassroots Radio and have everybody call the NRSC and the RNC National and put that pressure on, because the deadline is passed. We're tired of messing around. And if Claire McCaskill goes back to Washington, D.C. in November, it's not because of the efforts of the good conservatives in Missouri. It's on the RNC. They had their chance to get behind Todd. We want them to get behind Todd. We want to take back the Senate. It's on them, and let's put that pressure on them to get that going. Todd needs that money. He's got everything else that he needs to take care of business in Washington, D.C. and to represent the people of Missouri. He just needs the money to get himself over the top in the election.
Yeah, absolutely, and you're very right. We will need those funds, and we appreciate it. If you guys are going to start something, you get people to make those calls, you know, that'll just be absolutely invaluable.
Okay, excellent. Ryan, if people want to get involved in the campaign, get yard signs, make donations, how can they find the Aiken campaign?
I tell you what, you can go to our website, Aiken.org, and from there, there's a launch pad for everything. Whether you're wanting to make phone calls, either from one of our phone banks in an office, or you can do it from the comfort of your own home. If you're wanting to come into the office and help with anything you can, you want to knock on doors, help us in parades before it gets too cold, or put together yard signs, or deliver them to people, all of those things, we can get you signed up on Aiken.org, or if you're looking to financially help, because that's what you feel like you can do best. You know, we will get you plugged in if we get your information on the Internet. So you let us know, and we'll put people to work. I tell you what, this campaign, since the very beginning of the primary run, has been a good group of hardworking people, both our staff and our volunteers. I am just thrilled with some of the people I've been able to work with, and just so incredibly motivated and moved by the passion and the loyalty to these principles and to our movement and our cause of conservative common sense. And it's just, sometimes it's just overwhelming how strong some of these people are, both our staff and our volunteers. And I tell you what, we need more good people, and we'll take them. Aiken.org, and we'll get you plugged in.
Okay, thank you so much, Ryan. We appreciate it. And give Todd our best, and we're pulling for him. And we'll send out the message for people to call the NRSC and put on a little pressure.
Absolutely, right, Lisa. And I appreciate you and what you're doing here on the Grassroots Radio. And we will look forward to working with you and being on. If you ever need anything, just give me a call.
Absolutely. We'll do that. We'll have you on regularly. We want to keep updated on the progress of the campaign. It's so important to win this race.
Absolutely it is. You're right on that. Well, I appreciate the time. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Ryan. That's Ryan Height from the Aiken campaign. Todd Aiken's communications director from and get in touch with him through Aiken.org, and also get in touch with the NRSC, and we'll get those numbers together and those email addresses together for you, so that maybe we can put a little pressure on the establishment GOP and make sure that they don't continue to throw that temper tantrum that they threw about a month ago. So that was Ryan Height, and we will move along now. Let's go to a commercial break, and we will be back with Bill Federer.
You better watch out. You better not cry. out, I'm telling you why.
Here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, it's Christmas in July and August and September. Last year on Christmas Eve, MGC paid off the department store layaway accounts of two Missouri families who were not able to provide Christmas for their children. This year, we would like to at least double that number, and in an attempt to do that by the holiday season, we're asking you to consider donating a few dollars toward that effort. We know the holiday season is the most difficult time of year to ask for donations, so we're planning ahead and asking you to give whatever you can so that a few Missouri families will be able to celebrate at Christmas. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and look for the Secret Santa page. All the details are there for you to donate by PayPal, check, or money order. Conservatives have proven to be the most generous and most benevolent people in the United States. Please help us with this very small charitable project.
This is the Grassroots Minute. On November 6th, St. Charles County voters will decide whether they want to keep their sheriff department intact with a sheriff elected by the people, or drastically diminish it and establish a county-wide police department with a chief appointed by the county executive. It's simple, really, elected versus appointed. St. Charles County law enforcement should remain independent and headed by an elected sheriff who is directly accountable to citizens and not to the whims of an elected official. To see just how politics are injected into a county police department, you need to look no further than St. Louis County. From the beginnings of our country, independent county sheriffs have been established across the nation, and their sworn duty remains the same as those established over 200 years ago, to protect the rights, property, and civil liberties of the citizens living within the county. The overwhelming majority of the sheriff's department staff in St. Charles County are opposed to the creation of a county police department, as should the voters of St. Charles County. During a time when the rights to vote couldn't mean more to a citizen of this country, your county council, county executive, and your current sheriff want to take away your right to select a chief law enforcement officer of your community. If this occurs, the newly formed chief would only have to answer to the county executive and the county council, not the citizens that employ him. November 6th, vote no in county charter question law enforcement. I'm Terry Varner for the Grassroots Minute.
Our well-being at home and our leadership abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
Welcome back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We have an action-packed hour full of great information and great folks to talk to. I want to remind you folks to go to Missouri Grassroots Coalition .org and look at the Secret Santa page there. We have a tab there just for the Secret Santa initiative that the Missouri Grassroots Coalition is trying to promote. We are really interested in, last year the Missouri Grassroots Coalition put together a little philanthropic project where they aided a couple of needy Missouri families in paying off their layaway accounts that had some toys left over in them on Christmas Eve for their kids. And they went in and they paid those accounts off on Christmas Eve and saved a couple of families' Christmases and kept that magic alive for some kids in Missouri. We're trying to double the number of families that we help this year. So if you have the opportunity to go, we're falling behind on donations. We know that everybody's busy with elections and stuff, but we just want to raise $500 this year. We're not asking for a lot of money. And we know that there times have been a little tougher this year for some Missouri families than maybe they were last year. So we would just like to maybe continue this tradition with Missouri Grassroots Coalition and go and help a couple more Missouri families and keep the magic of Christmas alive for their families. So go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and send us a couple of bucks, PayPal, check, or money order, and help us with that project. And I want to say thank you to Dave, because Dave has done a lot of work on the radio, kind of keeping things going when some of us are too busy to do other things, and he put together some great intros for me, and I've been using them the last couple of weeks, and I just love them, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Dave yet this evening, so I want to say hello to him and welcome him and thank him for his contribution. Thank you, Dave.
Well, you're welcome, Lisa. Thank you very much.
I've had a really bad technical day, and most of the time you keep me on track with the technical stuff, and I've just been kind of floundering here today. So
I heard. Yeah, you had little power outages there and some on and off cable issues.
Yeah, when we finally got some rain, it took the cable with it. So I haven't had cable for a while, and it evidently took the Skype with it too, because Skype's not working either. So thanks for running the board for me today and taking care of business.
No worries.
Okay, we have Bill Federer with us tonight. He is just, words just can't describe the kind of knowledge that this man has. I can't imagine how many years that he's been studying this issue. And when most of us were sleeping, you know, most of us were not really paying attention to what's been going on with the Middle East. We haven't been studying the Islamic culture and what that means in contrast to what our culture is here in America. And Bill Federer, there's probably almost no one who knows better and who can explain better what's going on over there in the Middle East and how that's going to affect us here in America. Thank you for being with us, Bill.
Lisa, great to be with you.
I really can't tell you, it's an honor to have you on the program, and I've heard you speak several times before. I've got your book, and I'm just floored at the information that's in the book, and I've heard you speak, the things that come out of your mouth, and they're just it's very eye-opening. If no one's ever had the opportunity to speak, take advantage of it if he's in your area, because you'll learn things that you just would have never would have imagined it could be possible. And with everything that's going on here in the Middle East the last couple of weeks and the things that have been going on in the UN in the last days, we're kind of hoping maybe you can give us some perspective on how that's really going to play out for us in our everyday lives, Bill.
Well, thank you, Lisa. Well, past behavior is the best indicator of future performance. You're going to hire somebody for a job. Well, how did they do on their last job? And so we happen to have 1,400 years of past behavior that we can look at. Now, it's important to understand Muhammad was the perfect Muslim. So today, Muslims that want to be better Muslims, they're wanting to be like him. And so if we understand his life, it's like the DNA. We know what direction those that are following him are wanting to go. So if we zoom in on Muhammad's life, born in 570 AD, he's 25 years old, marries a 40-year-old widow, Khadija. But in 610 AD is when he begins his faith. And from 610 to 622, 12 years, he is in the pagan city of Mecca and only makes 70 converts in 12 years. He is chased out of town in 622 AD because he was disturbing the peace, and he goes to Medina, which was a Jewish city 210 miles to the north. Now, the Jews were nice enough to let him in, and he was a refugee, an immigrant, and he presented his faith to the Jews, and they reject him, and so he goes into the minority neighborhoods in the town, and he begins to get a little following. Matter of fact, he gets enough of a following where he goes back to the Jewish leaders and he presents himself as a new type of candidate, that he can rise above the partisanship of the different tribes that have been in Medina, because he's a newcomer. And so the Jews in Medina make a treaty with Muhammad, and so now he is a political leader as well as a religious leader. Then something happens. His followers back in Mecca, they get a little pushy, argumentative, and threatening, the way some of his followers are today. They get chased out of town for disturbing the peace, and they flee north to Medina. And Muhammad sort of does this victimhood thing where you were the victims because they were intolerant of you. Therefore, you are justified in robbing the caravans headed back to Mecca. And so Muhammad has 300 men, and they attack and rob caravans. He gets a whole chapter of the Quran from his Allah on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. It's chapter 8, Surah 8. A man with no wife gets one portion, a man with a wife gets two portions. And so it's a little different than Jesus, who said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt. If they strike you on one cheek, let them strike the other. If they persecute you, pray for them. Muhammad said, if they take your house, you retaliate and take their caravan. And so the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 defeats 1,000 at the Battle of Badra in 624 AD. This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad to be a military leader. And he fights in 66 battles in the next 8 years before he dies. He even used the catapult when he attacked a city called Al-Ta'if. And when he was told the catapult was killing innocent women and children, his response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers today say it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And since he is the perfect Muslim, Muslims today that want to be better Muslims, they want to be like him religiously, politically, and militarily. That's why the more fundamental they get, the more violent they get. Now, it's interesting. Is this making sense?
Yeah, you know, it raises a question, though, and it's been a question that I think a lot of people have about, you know, the fundamental radical Muslims and then the difference between the peaceful Muslims. And, you know, what if a perfect Muslim is like Muhammad, you know, are there peaceful Muslims? Because the fundamental Islamic religion is not a religion of the kind of peace that we know here in our culture in America.
Good question. Well, Islam is a religion of peace, but their definition of the word peace is different than ours. Our definition of peace is different groups learning how to get along. The fundamental definition of peace for a Muslim is when the whole world submits to the will of Allah, there will be peace. So to them, world peace means world Islam. So their roadmap for peace with Israel is to have Israel submit to Allah. It should be called a roadmap for coexistence, but no, it's a roadmap for peace, and they think there'll be world peace when all of Islam's enemies are defeated. So that's their goal. Now, a moderate Muslim thinks the world will submit to Allah later. Maybe at the end of the world, maybe it's even figurative. And since it's so far off in the distant future, just get along with the infidels. You can, you know, have your life, have your family. To them, they're really not concerned. They just want to live their life. The fundamental Muslim, though, on the other hand, thinks the world is submitting to Allah now. And they're really excited, and they want to help make it happen. Now, the dilemma for the West is the more we bend over backwards in unprecedented ways to show ourselves tolerant, the more the moderate Muslim begins to rethink and say, wait a second, we've never had a U.S. president apologizing at the United Nations, buying advertisement in Pakistan to apologize. We've never had 3,000 Muslims praying on the U.S. Capitol lawn to Mecca and Muslim Miss America and Muslim postage stamps and, you know, presidents celebrating Ramadan in the White House. This has never happened before. Maybe the world is, in fact, submitting to Allah now rather than later. And so they gravitate from the future peaceful moderate camp into the fundamental now camp, which is the violent camp. So all of our efforts to apologize and show ourselves hyper-tolerant is actually creating more violence. It's really simple. It's sort of like a football game. Our attitude has been, if we can just give up 10 yards and let them get a first down, they'll get nice and they'll let us get a first down. Well, we give up a first down and they're playing harder. So we think, okay, let them get a touchdown. Then they'll play really nice and they'll let us get a touchdown. We let them get a touchdown and they're even playing harder. And we can't understand that the more we give up, the more they're getting enthused and packing out the stadium and they're getting very energized, right? And so the more we pull back our troops, the more we apologize, the more we let them pull down American flags from our embassies and raise Al-Qaeda flags and kill our ambassadors and we do nothing, this is very enthusiastic and exciting to them. Does this make sense?
Yes, it does. And it kind of leads me to question, the Muslim religion, the Islamic culture does not respect, they look at this as weakness in us.
Is that right? They don't respect this behavior.
Right. International politics is really simple. It's the law of the jungle. And if a lion is chasing a zebra and the zebra stumbles and falls and thinks, gee, if I can just bend my neck back a little bit more and show him how submissive I am, he'll get nice? Really? No. The moment you give up the Gaza Strip and think, this is it, I'll just show myself really, really tolerant, that encourages aggression. They just move missiles in a little bit closer. And so we're sort of backwards on this. And so the question is the president simply unaware of this, or is he doing this intentionally, trying to stir up a crisis in the Middle East before the election? And if it gets bad enough, then he can use this as an excuse to be the FDR wartime president and take control of the radio, TV, and internet and begin to usurp a whole bunch of powers, and it'll happen right before the election.
No, I mean, seriously, he can't be. I mean, he's got to be aware of it. He grew up in the Muslim culture. So it's really hard to believe that he's not aware of what he's doing.
Well, you're right. And it's interesting, the Muslim culture, they don't split church and state because Muhammad was all three. So Muhammad was a religious leader, a political leader, and a military leader. Therefore, Islam is a religious system, a political system, and a military system. Therefore, a mosque is a religious building, a political building, and a military building. Therefore, bowing to Mecca is a religious bowing, a political bowing, and a military pledging of allegiance to another capital. There's no way to split him because he was all three. Now, you can't have some that are backslidden, and they sort of get away from it, and they think it's going to happen in the future. But we're helping them to change and come into the now category. Now, again, past behavior is the best indicator of future performance. And so we look at the past and we see, when have they been peaceful and when have they been violent? Well, Muhammad dies in the year 632 AD, and within 100 years of his death, the rightly guided caliphs conquer all of Arabia. There used to be Ghassanids, who were Arab Christians there. They conquered Yemen, which had been a Jewish kingdom for centuries. They conquered Jerusalem in 638 AD, and it had been a Byzantine Christian city since Constantine. Then they conquer Syria. Syria's in the news today. Syria was the first country to completely be Christian, evangelized by the Apostle Paul, and Antioch, Syria, was where Christians were first called Christians. That was where the name was invented, was in Syria. And then they conquered Egypt. Egypt had been Christian for six centuries, Coptic Christian. The word Coptic is the Egyptian word for Egyptian in their old language. But, and matter of fact, the Coptic Christian church was started by Mark, that wrote the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. When the Muslims invaded, they had to smuggle the bones of Mark out of Egypt by packing them under pork. And they shipped them to Venice, Italy, and that was St. Mark's Cathedral. And then, when they invaded in the year 642 into Egypt, they decided not just was their religion superior, but their language was. And so they cut out the tongues of anybody caught speaking Coptic. They eradicated the Coptic language. That's why they speak Arabic in this Coptic Egyptian country, right? Then there used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th century. All of today, what is Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, and Libya? That used to all be Catholic. But in one generation, the Muslims wiped them out. And then in the year 711, the Muslims invaded Spain. And the Spaniards were still fighting on foot with heavy metal swords. And the Muslims came in on their Arabian horses with their scimitar swords and the stirrup. The stirrup was a new invention that came from China, the Mongols, where you could ride and control your horse instead of just letting your feet dangle, and you could fight on horseback. And the scimitar swords were very light and sharp, like razor blades, and the curve meant that no matter where you hit your target, the full force of your stroke was there versus a straight blade. And so they could literally slice somebody in half while riding at a full gallop. In 10 years, they conquer all of Spain. They cross the Pyrenees Mountains. They conquer southern France. Pope Gregory puts out a plea that anybody that could fight should join Charles Martel. He was the grandfather of Charlemagne. Charles Martel gets 30,000 volunteers just outside of Paris. It tours France. And these guys are straight off the farm, dressed with animal pelts and axes. But this is the largest army in Europe. You could go all the way to Poland, and there was not another 30,000-man army lying around. So if Charles Martel had not been successful in stopping the Islamic invasion, we would be speaking Arabic right now, because German, French, and English would have never developed as languages. We'd be like Egypt, where the Coptics had their tongues cut out. Anyway, in the year 732 AD, Charles Martel puts his men on top of a hill. And when the Muslim commander, Abdul Rahman, charges up the hill, he thinks it's just a line of men. Well, he charges in, and it's a block, a 30,000 square of these men, and they get stuck. And meanwhile, Charles Martel had prearranged for some of his men to sneak into the Muslim tents and free the captives. And you see, the Muslims fought for religion, but they also fought for plunder. Muhammad said you can have four wives plus as many other women as your right hand possesses as you take in battle. Now, they don't have the status of a wife. They're like slave wives and concubines. Now, the sultan got a fifth. That was Muhammad's portion. So many sultans had 1,000 wives. Anyway, as these warriors saw their booty being snuck out of the camp, they would leave the fight to protect their stuff. And the commander, Abdul Rahman, tries to rally his soldiers back at the Battle of Tours. He gets distracted. He gets killed. And now the Muslim warriors cannot decide who their next commander is going to be. So they pick up and go back to Spain. That was the Battle of Tours in 732 AD, exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. They went from the tents of Arabia to Paris in 100 years, and it was all a military campaign. And so we see that these were the rightly guided caliphs. These were the ones that got it straight, right? And they had a religious system, a political system, and a military system. Anyway, that was the first Arab Spring, went from the Persian Gulf to the Atlantic Ocean. Then there was a second spring. Do I have a moment to share that?
Sure.
Over by Mongolia, there were the Turks, Seljuk Turks, Ottoman Turks, and they converted to Islam. And they invaded the Byzantine Empire, which is today Turkey. And back then it was all Christian. All seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were all there. They were all wiped out by the Muslims. Of course, the Byzantine Empire was very proud, and so it was a humbling thing for them to beg the West for help. The West did send help, though, and it was called what?
You tell
called
me.
The Crusades. The Crusades. There were 9 major Crusades in 200 years. Richard the Lionheart led the Third Crusade. Here's a trivia question. Who led the 7th and 8th Crusades against the Muslims?
Who?
St. Louis.
Oh, wonderful.
And you can see him on his Crusader horse there at Art Hill, right? He even went to Egypt to try to save the Christians there. Anyway, the Crusades finally fizzle, and they withdraw. But they served a purpose. They bought Europe 2 centuries. So the Muslims were tied up fighting on their turf, sort of like a Vietnam. Meanwhile, it gave the Europeans a chance to, you know, develop. But they still invaded Europe. In the year 1453, the Muslims surrounded the capital of the world. It was Constantinople, where the Black Sea empties into the Mediterranean. Constantine had moved the capital of the Roman Empire to that spot, and it was sort of like a New York, Washington, D.C., political, financial capital. The Muslims conquer Constantinople in the year 1453. Now, that year is significant, 1453. When they conquered it, it ended the land trade routes to get from Europe over to India and China. People forget from Roman times, there was trade from the Han Dynasty in China to the Parthian Dynasty and the Kushan Indian Dynasty and all the way over to Greece and then into the Roman Empire. Matter of fact, Marco Polo, the game the kids play around the pool, he was an Italian from Venice, Italy, that in the year 1271 went over to China, worked for Kublai Khan for 24 years, brought back to Europe spaghetti, coal, these burning rocks, thread from worms that was as strong as steel, silkworms. He brought back gunpowder and also plates that were not made out of metal or wood. They were made out of China. We call it China because it came from China. And he talked about Kublai Khan inventing paper currency. Marco Polo was amazed that you could buy all this stuff with a piece of paper. Anyway, unfortunately, Kublai Khan printed too many of them, and that contributed to the Mongolian Empire falling. But the Europeans traded. But finally, in 1453, the Muslims conquered Constantinople and ended the land trade. And so what happened about 40 years later? Let's see, 1453, 40, that would be 1492. So what happened then? a guy named Columbus said, hey, I know another route to get to India and China without going through the Muslim lands, sail west. Columbus thinks he's in India, so he names the inhabitants the Indians. Think of it. We would not call Native Americans Indians, and Columbus would have never even set sail if it had not been for Islamic Jihad. Our very country being discovered is a byproduct of Islamic Jihad cutting off the land routes, right?
Outlining all of these things, I mean, so you made your point in the very beginning very clearly. You know, the history does repeat itself, and history is repeating itself again. So it's not a stretch for us to look at this information, this great history that you've outlined, and to see that the Muslims are interested in conquering the world, and they're trying to do it. They're setting themselves up to conquer the world through the United States. They've got strong footholds in Europe. You know, the Middle East is burning, and it's not a stretch to speculate that the United States is just ripe for the fall.
Well, it's interesting. The Ottoman Empire finally started falling and was dismantled after World War I. And France took a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Lebanon and Syria. Britain took a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Palestine and Iraq, later gave birth to Israel out of that. They wanted America to take a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Armenia. We said no, and they killed 1.5 million Armenian Christians, among them being Cynthia Davis's great-grandfather. If you talk to the former state rep, Cynthia Davis, her family's Armenian. And, you know, these are her relatives that were killed. Anyway, the Ottoman Empire was gone. Sir Lawrence of Arabia organized these Arab Muslims to fight the Turkish Ottomans. And so the Muslim world viewed itself as defeated. And the West was developing airplanes, telephones, and televisions. And for 2 centuries, the British Empire had been the most powerful empire in the world. Now America after World War I and then II. And so the Muslim world said, okay, let's see. We're still on camels. They're driving cars and planes. Let's distance ourselves from our secular, from our fundamental cousins, and let's make our leaders secular. And let's send our kids to Western schools and learn English and dress with business suits. And so we got the Shah of Iran, who loved America. We got these different leaders over there that loved America, or they at least would work with us, or we could bribe them under the table, you know, to make a treaty with Israel. And so everything was moving in this direction until 2 things happened. One, the Muslim Brotherhood was started in 1928, and they said it's time to start an Arab Spring and force the world to submit to Allah again. But they were still just wandering around the desert sands until 1938, oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia. And within one generation, the West pumps so many billions of dollars over there that Saudi Arabia becomes the richest Muslim country. And they use that money to finance Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and 9 out of 10 mosques in America are financed by Saudi Arabia. They're the number one publisher of Islamic textbooks, and, you know, they've got the textbooks where it shows where to cut off the hands of the thieves and so forth, and, you know. And so we're financing this third wave, this Arab Spring. Now, our president is using our military and our foreign policy to pull the rug out from under the remaining dictators and to usher in the Muslim Brotherhood so that they can control the entire Middle East. And the Muslim Brotherhood's goal is to have a one-world government ruled by one Muslim leader called a caliph. And so our president's foreign policy is to orchestrate this. And Michelle Bachmann, who's a congresswoman, who's a friend of mine, and I know her and her husband, and she said that there's enough evidence to show that Hillary Clinton's right-hand gal has mysterious connections that look like with the Muslim Brotherhood, and she asked for an investigation. And you know what? Just 2 weeks ago at the Iftar Muslim dinner at our U.S. White House, President Obama praises this woman, saying, oh, what a great job she's doing in the Middle East, when there is credible evidence she's connected with the Muslim Brotherhood that's doing all these things. So in America, we're sort of we don't know our history. We don't really know much of what's going on today. But you can connect the dots, and past behavior is the best indicator of future performance. Anyway, hope this made sense.
Absolutely. So, Bill, if we want to learn more about this, there's just mountains and mountains of things to learn about this and to translate it to understand what's going on today. What every American needs to know about the Quran is just an amazing book, and you have a new book out as well.
All right. Well, I also have two DVDs on Islam. One is called Islamic Conquest, Past and Present, and it's 5 half-hour TV shows that I recorded. And another is called Political Islam's War on the West, and it's 8 programs. And all these are available on my website, AmericanMinute.com. And I've written about 20 other books, and I don't know how much time there is for me to talk more, but if you want, I can share you a little bit.
We would love to have you back and let you promote every single one of them. It's just amazing the information that's just packed into this, these books and these DVDs, I'm sure. And in your head, you're fascinating to listen to. You've just got so much great information and you present it so well. We appreciate you being on with us. I hope you'll come back again because we'd really like some more information on this topic. I mean, it's so relevant to what's going on today, and we've been asleep for so long, people just do not understand how this all relates to our, you know, what's going on around the world.
Well, I'd be honored to, Lisa, and just give me a call or my website for those that are interested is AmericanMinute.com. And I also sent out a free daily email called The American Minute, something that happened in history on that day.
Okay, can we sign up through it on your website there?
Yes, AmericanMinute.com.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Bill. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Lisa. Look forward to keeping in touch.
Good. That was Bill Federer. Go to AmericanMinute.com. If you haven't had the opportunity to pick up What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, it's just an amazing history of the entire Islamic religion and culture. And go to Bill's website again, AmericanMinute.com, and we're going to take a quick break. And we're going to come back and talk to Ray Cuneo about Agenda 21, speaking of One World Order, maybe from another aspect of it, the UN's Agenda 21. Again, fascinating information, things you need to know. We'll be right back.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
For peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Okay, we are back. Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We've had a lot going on tonight, and we've still got plenty to go, so stay with us. So we have Ray Cuneo with us. Ray, I've heard Ray speak before as well, and I bumped into him a couple of weeks ago at the Locke and Smith banquet and had a great conversation with him. Ray is also a wealth of knowledge about Agenda 21, and here at Missouri Grassroots Radio, we've been trying to find somebody who knows a great deal about that subject to kind of educate our listeners on that issue because it's so important. And again, it's another issue that Americans, it's very complicated. Americans really don't understand how this is creeping into our American way of life and hitting us on every level of government. And Ray's here to tell us just a little bit about that tonight. Hi, Ray. Thanks for being with us.
Well, good evening, Lisa. It's great to be here. And I was listening in on Bill Federer's discussion about Islam. That is very interesting. I heard him speak at a Lincoln Day banquet back in the spring, and he's an interesting man with full of really amazing knowledge of history.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I found it interesting. He mentioned, I think, that the term was caliph, which is a world ruler, and it's interesting. He's talking about Muslim and conquering the world. Well, and I think you mentioned in your intro there that We're under assault from another angle also, and it's really coming at us through the United Nations. So it's better known as Agenda 21, for better for worse, primarily for worse. And as you pointed out, most Americans, well, probably 95, 99%, whatever the number is, 90%, have never heard of it. And those that have probably haven't dug into it too far because, as you pointed out, it is a very complex subject, and it's intended to be that way. So I'd be glad to cover, start any place you like. We can start at the very beginning, or we can jump in and just talk about what it involves.
Okay. Well, you know, I intend to kidnap Ray on a regular basis and have him here on the show to talk about this subject for as long as I can get him to continue to come on. But if you want to do your own research, you can go to the UN website. It's all there, laid out for you on the UN website. I mean, it's almost just shocking how unabashedly, upfront they are with this agenda. You know, I mean, they just spell it all out for you. I mean, it takes a while to get through it all, and I admit that I haven't gone through it all with any depth. But, I mean, it's they're not trying to hide it, are they, Ray?
No, and I think you make an important point there, and it's a good place to start. It's not a conspiracy. Those of us that's been fighting it. The proponents of it always accuse us of being conspiracy theorists. It's not a partisan issue, and it's nothing less, in my opinion, than a grand plan by powerful forces both in this country and out of this country to destroy our republic and our American way of life, our economy, and really the ultimate goal in my opinion, and those of us that have been researching this, some of whom are much smarter than I am, is to push us in this country into a unit of world government. And I think anybody that researches it far enough will see that. I would like to, if we're going to try to do this on an ongoing basis, which I'll certainly try to do, and it's going to take some time, I think it's important to start and take whatever time this evening we can. It's important for those that are hearing it for the first time to understand a brief history of how Agenda 21, Sustainable Development, came about. The concept of sustainable development was developed over a couple of decades through various United Nations conferences and meetings that really led up to a meeting of the a World Commission on Environment and Development in 1987. This was a UN conference, and it was chaired by a lady by the name of Gro Harlem Brundtland, who just happened to be at the time the VP of the World Socialist Party. And So between 1987 and 1982, the whole concept of sustainable development, and we're going to get into that, what's involved and what it means, but it was developed over about a five-year period. And then when we got into 1992 at the World Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, that is where it was presented as official UN policy. Now, I think it's important for your listeners to understand and listen carefully what happened in 1992. It was a watershed event, and it produced three profound documents. One was the Biodiversity Treaty. The second was the Climate Change Treaty, which more people have heard discussed, better known as a cap and trade more recently, et cetera. And the last, but not least, of course, was the master blueprint, Agenda 21 Sustainable Development. It's important for people to realize these are all interconnected, although Agenda 21 Sustainable Development is the master plan governing the functioning of the other two, but they all tie together. And they were all intended to become treaties eventually, in world treaties, binding treaties, including the United States. But so Agenda 21 Sustainable Development became an official policy, UN policy in 1992. It's a 40 chapter, 300 page blueprint. In my opinion, it's a blueprint for transforming all of the world societies into one socialist slash fascist utopian society. And as I said, making, of course, the United States a unit of world government. The George H. Bush, President George H. Bush, in 1992 attended the UN conference there in Rio, and he represented the United States, and he signed the Sustainable Development Treaty. Now, I call it a treaty. There's different designations for these type of treaties that come out of the UN. It was known as a non-binding signatory treaty. And what that means is that each nation wasn't necessarily going to be bound by international law to conform to it, but a signatory treaty means that each signature nation goes back to the respective nations and tries to implement the provisions laid out in Agenda 21, Sustainable Development, as best they can. And hopefully at some point in the future, then it would be a reconvening and conference to lay it and take it to a binding treaty. At the same time in 1992, there were 178 other countries signed that treaty, that non-binding signatory treaty. Al Gore, who was VP candidate at the time, he attended that Rio conference as a member of the official U.S. delegation. And then that fall, of course, that autumn, George H. Bush lost the presidency to Bill Clinton. In June of the following year, June 29, 1993, President Clinton signed Executive Order 12852, which established the President's Council on Sustainable Development. That and we'll get into, well, I guess I could cover that now because it's important that people understand what the President's Council did. The President's Council on Sustainable Development was directed by this executive order to develop specific policies for implementation administratively on sustainable development throughout all of the United U.S. federal agencies. All of this without any congressional legislation or oversight. It was exclusively an executive protocol, not protocol, but an executive effort. And the President's Council on Sustainable Development consisted of top executives from some of the major environmental groups like the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, also 12 cabinet members and three corporate executives. I believe they were Brown and Ferris, S.C. Johnson, and, Enron. At any rate, the President's Council that was formed up in 1993, operated until 1999. They took the direction from the executive order and Americanized Agenda 21 in three publications, Sustainable America, New Consensus, a progress report on Sustainable America, and then the road to a sustainable sustainability, a snapshot of activities in the United States. So that laid the groundwork. And in those 6 years there, they developed policy, implemented it through all federal agencies at direction of the executive order. Now, they also developed seven task force reports. And what's interesting, and to my knowledge, these are not online. You can't get them on the Internet. Maybe you can. I haven't really tried to search for them, but they're no longer in print. Now, back in 1993, we didn't have all the Internet and Google and all these things. Everything was done in print. It just so happens I have all of the hard copies of all of these documents, and on occasion when I travel around and do some speaking, sometimes I just take those to show people there are really hard copy documents that were developed here in the United States to implement Agenda 21. Now, history then, go ahead.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about what sustainable development. Let's try to give a definition of what that really means and what that looks like to people on a local level.
Well, okay. First, let me quote what the United Nations has defined sustainable development to mean. It means, and this is from the United Nations documents, development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. Well, whoopee-doo, I mean, hasn't all generations really done that? I mean, one way or another. We're here, and there's been many, many succeeding generations. So that's a generic concept, and it really is what they're saying there is we really need to control all factors that go into development so that we, meaning the government, so that we can assure that it'll be there for the future. Now, getting into some of the specifics of what is involved in the 40 chapters and 300 pages, which also are in our U.S. documents that I just covered. It covers everything. It covers all education, financial, land use, environmental, resource use, transportation, international agreements, agriculture. And to be specific about it, Agenda 21 is the integration into society of three principles: the environment, the economy, and social justice. The balancing of these three principles in society, of course, will be determined by government, the central authority of the planners. And the environment will always be the dominant overriding principle. And government is at some level, is going to be the ones to decide the balancing of these three goals throughout society. Agenda 21, it advocates the abolishment of property rights, modern agriculture, national sovereignty, the free market capitalistic economy. It promotes redistribution of wealth, social justice, and basically a command and control economy. Some of the other goals are reduce consumption, control of factors of production, as I said before, promote social equity, and require the preservation and restoration of biodiversity or the environment. Focusing on three components: land use, global education, and population control and reduction. Those are the overriding specific goals of Agenda 21, sustainable development as created by the United Nations and incorporated into official U.S. policy.
Okay. I mean, it's all very clear. If anybody's been reading the newspaper or watching TV, I mean, that's the Obama administration's modus operandi. I mean, it's all right there in every aspect. We're running a little short on time. I would love for you to come back next time, and we can get.
Well,
I want to get a little bit deeper into this if we can.
Well, my intention. I'm just scratching the surface, Lisa, because we can get a lot deeper into. And you wanted to know what it means to local people. Now, we got to cover this so we can get to that point, so people can understand what's happening to them, and this is what led up to it.
Absolutely, and I mean, you can look at this and you can see this in the Obama administration's agenda right there. But also, people need to understand, and we can get into this deeper because it's very important. Not only is it going on at a national, federal level, it's going on at your county level.
Man, we're going to get into that. That takes a lot of time, and we're going to get into that because people need to understand specifically what they see happening around them, as you point out, at the local level, and where it came from and why it is happening.
And how that ties in. I mean, this is eminent domain issues. This is what's going on in our schools. This is everything. It's just frightening how all-encompassing. I mean, the noose is around our necks, and it's just waiting to be tightened.
Let me point out what Al Gore said in reference to sustainable development in his 1994 book, Earth in the Balance. He referred to it as requiring a wrenching transformation of society. Now, don't you find it interesting what the slogan of the Obama administration is, to fundamentally transform America? It's interesting how those two phrases tie together.
Yep, it's all right there, and they're not trying to hide it, folks. So between now and the next time that I'm able to talk Ray into coming on, please go to the Agenda 21 website. Ray, is there anywhere else that we can go to get information?
You can go to sovereignty.net. I think that was Henry Lamb's website. He passed away back in May. Last time I checked, it was still up at sovereignty.net. And you can also go to Tom DeWeese's American Policy Center. .org.
Okay.
And both of those fellows I've known for 15 years. There's been a handful of us since about 1994-95 that have been aware of this Agenda 21. And of course, as they say, the chickens are just now coming home to roost, and people slowly but surely are beginning to wake up to it. I'm not sure, but in essence, Lisa, we've been slow-boiled. The American people have been slow-boiled. Their representatives have been slow-boiled. A lot of this is already happening, is happening, and will continue to happen unless the American people wake up, and also their elected officials.
Right, and we need to turn things back. We need to demand some repeal, not only on a national level and a state level, but on a local level in your communities. People need to understand what's going on, and we need to undo this. This is bad news.
Well, there's a lot more to cover in this, and we can try to do that at a later time if you want.
Absolutely.
We can talk about all the primary methods of implementation. We can talk about the players who are involved in it. It's just not the federal government. It's just not government agencies. There's NGOs involved. We can go through all of those things. We can talk about what the Obama administration is currently doing. They have fast-tracked this thing. They've got it pretty well accomplished accomplished at the federal level. The states have pretty much over the last 20 years become surrogates of the states and the federal government in implementing policy provisions of Agenda 21. Now the final throws are coming in to put the noose, if you will, around and tie up local government. And unfortunately, local leaders are being duped into this, and there's reasons for that. I'm not making excuses for them. I'm a planning and zoning commissioner in Franklin County. I know how these things work, how they come into a local government body, and there's a lot of factors at play how it gets there, and it's all by design by the federal government. And we can get at a later date, if you want, we can get into all of these specifics, exactly how it happens.
Okay, we will. We will absolutely address these. Ray, I really appreciate you being on with us tonight and giving us this introduction to Agenda 21. And I want you to come back as soon as you're willing to do that, and we'll just continue to move on this subject. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Lisa.
Okay, we'll talk to you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. That's Cuneo, Agenda 21. And we will have him back. We're going to take another real quick break here. And we're going to come back with some information on the St. Charles police situation.
This is the Grassroots Minute. All over the country, public union leaders are demanding that communities come up with extra cash. And unions around the country are testing the waters by having teachers and budget-stricken districts to vote no confidence in the community, send a message to taxpayers to cough up cash or else. As cash-strapped municipalities deal with acquiring tax revenues, and not too rosy projections made by administrators and union officials. Teacher unions are stamping their feet, holding their breath, and threatening, "Give us what we want and we will strike." For years, public education has been in terrible shape in this country. Test scores are falling in the U.S. compared to other nations. At the K-12 level, we are graduating fewer students ready for college. Around 77% of students who take the ACT test aren't college ready, according to the ACT. Yet in school district after school district in this country, budgets are being busted by union benefits that have been bankrolled by union campaign contributions taken out of your tax dollars. Since 1992, the American Federation of Teachers have given $30 million in campaign contributions to Democrats who essentially run the education bureaucracy in this country, while donating less than 1% of that to Republicans. That's why in the Democrat-controlled Chicago, teachers went on strike after the district offered them a whopping 60% raise over 4 years. The union demanded 30%. Teachers in Chicago already make an average salary of $76,000, reports the CBS local news affiliate, while New York City teachers average $73,000. Only 21% of Chicago public school 8th graders are proficient in reading, and only 20% scored at grade level in mathematics, according to the U.S. Department of Education. Chicago lags behind the national public school average, which lags behind the international average of industrialized nations. In Chicago, the teacher strike was preceded by a token vote of no confidence to the city, circulated by the Chicago Teachers Union, an affiliate of the American Federation of Teachers. I'm thinking, where can we, the taxpayers, register a vote of no confidence to the unions? I'm Terry Barnard for the Grassroots Minute.
Okay, we're running really long here tonight, so we're going to go straight. I talked to Terry Herring a little bit earlier today, and we have some action items for the folks who want to get involved in the police issue in St. Charles County, so I'm going to let you listen to that interview right now.
This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. And true to form, as Culture Vigilantes, we're going to take control of the situation with the Save Our Sheriff's Department in St. Charles County. We're here with Terry Herring. He's got some information for us this week about how we can get involved and engaged and take control of this problem ourselves so that we don't have to deal with switching over from a sheriff's department to an appointed police chief and police department. Terry, thanks for being with us today.
It's always good to chat with you, Lisa.
So, Terry,
I'm sorry? And folks out there in radio land.
Absolutely. So, Terry, we're doing our best to educate the folks on this situation in St. Charles County. You know, and I have talked to several people over the past few weeks. This whole trend seems to be across the country, but there's a movement across the country to get rid of sheriff's departments and go to appointed police departments, and that seems to be what's happening here in St. Charles County, and people need to understand that are listening, even though you're not in St. Charles County, this could happen to you next. I've said that every week since we've found this problem here in St. Charles County, this could happen to you, so you need to be aware of what's going on here and watch this situation very closely. And what we're trying to do here is to get the people engaged and involved. There's a lot of questions that have come up, and we want to address those questions today about why are we bothering to mess with a perfectly good sheriff's department that's running efficiently, effectively. You know, it's cost-effective. We've got good people in place. Good officers in place. If it ain't broke, why are we fixing it, Terry?
Lisa, I can't answer why we're fixing it because you've made a good case for it not having to be touched. You're correct that there appears to be a movement across the country to replace elected sheriffs with appointed police chiefs. And the thing that concerns me about that is that we have taken one more critical element out of the voters' hands, and that is their county sheriff. Because at least when you have a direct vote for your sheriff from the eligible voters, the sheriff does have to be responsible to the members of the community, to the members of the county, and so forth. But an elected sheriff is every 4 years. An appointed police chief basically could serve indefinitely. And depending on who the appointing authorities are in the county, this could have a very, very long-term impact and really circumvent the people. I would say, in my humble opinion, and I'm not a law enforcement professional, I'm just a private citizen, but this would make it the position of police chief more susceptible to, I would say, political influence.
Cronyism. I mean, and not that we don't have enough cronyism in St. Charles County already, but, I mean, this just really sets the stage for cronyism.
Now, again, if it's not broke, don't fix it, and the Sheriff's Department has been functioning quite effectively for a long time. The people appear satisfied with the services, and if we make change for all the wrong reasons, as a former client of mine said years ago, there's no right way to do a wrong thing.
Right.
And I believe that we are doing a wrong thing here.
Okay, let's move to another question that we've raised before. When you read the charter, the bill that was introduced to the county council to introduce this charter and to put it on the ballot, there was a credentials element, and we just want to touch on this again. The one of the purposes or one of the reasons that the sheriff had for introducing this whole situation to the county council was that he wanted to put qualified people in place to ensure that we had, you know, professional people running the police department. But there is a caveat in this charter that nullifies the very purpose of putting this whole issue in the first place, right, Terry?
Lisa, let me turn to that page. And that is, let's see.
I mean, there's a whole running list of what credentials are necessary for a police chief. And then the caveat says something like, or
okay,
commensurate experience.
This is section 4.250.2.3, and it reads as follows, and I'll read the entire thing. This is, again, referring to the chief law enforcement officer or chief of police of the county shall have a degree from an accredited four-year institution of higher learning and have completed one of the following: the Federal Bureau of Investigation National Academy Program, the Northwestern School of Staff and Command, the Southern Police Institute, or a similar program of at least 8 weeks' duration awarding a certificate of graduation. This is the class sentence of that section, and it reads, commensurate experience may substitute for the requirement of this section. So the last sentence basically obviated all the words that went before it.
Right, okay.
Because I have in an email that the sheriff sent me in response to my correspondence to the council, and I'm quoting in part, the primary reason is to ensure future chief law enforcement officers of the third largest county in the state will be a qualified law enforcement professional selected by a resume, qualifications, and experience. If this process is approved, it will automatically eliminate the turmoil pitting deputy against deputy, et cetera, during election years in the months following.
Right.
Every major municipality in this county has specific qualifications for the person responsible for the safety and security of their residents. Why should the largest law enforcement agency in the county have no standards or professional requirements for the same responsibilities? And so my question there is, if that is so important, why is that last sentence in that section?
Right. You know, if you're going to put it in, why waver at the end? Okay, and the last and most important detail of this, it should be to the taxpayers, is how much is this going to cost? The sheriff first initiated the idea that it wasn't going to cost anything. They were going to be able to pay for it through funds already accrued in the sheriff's department. And now, you know, there was, I think, a $100,000 figure floated out there. And the reality is there's been no cost analysis done in this very short time that this issue has been brought up to tell the public and the taxpayers of really how much this will cost them.
Well, that's exactly correct, Lisa. And my question is, at first it was no cost. Then it was $100,000, which was discussed across the table at the county council meeting, but quite frankly, nothing there was ever put in writing as a piece of a cost estimate. So if it's not in writing, it doesn't exist. It's air. And quite frankly...
You're just hoping that something doesn't happen to change that after the vote comes in, because they're not giving you anything concrete.
Well, there was no cost-benefit analysis done, and quite frankly, as a management professional, human resources director for some significantly large organizations in the past, and as a consultant, the way you economize and reduce costs is to consolidate functions, not to add another stovepipe function.
Right.
And this is exactly what we would be doing with this St. Charles County Police Department.
And, you know, and our county government seems to have a habit of doing these kinds of things related to finances all the time. I mean, they just passed an ordinance in the August election to put more money back into the roads and highways project when they have done they did that at the last minute right before it went on the ballot. You heard nothing about it until just a couple of weeks before, you know, giving the people no cost benefit analysis of the future road projects, and now they're doing it again with the sheriff's department issue. That your county government is not being straight up with you about the funding. You know, they're not giving you alternatives about how to negotiate the contracts or how to save money. They're just coming to you, asking you for more money, trusting, with the understanding that you're going to trust them to spend it in the right way. And we don't know that they're spending it in the right way. We don't know that they're going to spend it in the right way here as well.
Or an audit would be a good idea.
Audit's all over the place.
My concern with this is that this has been rushed through very quickly. It's almost... I hate to use a military term, but why not? We'll just call it shock and awe. It's gone through so fast. The people are not going to have a very good idea unless they listen to your show or they pay close attention to the Save Our Sheriff's Department .com website, which I seriously suggest that everybody take a look at. There is a tremendous amount of good information out there.
Okay.
Anything done in haste like this, 99 and 44, 100% of the time, results in what we might call unintended consequences.
Right. And as taxpayers, I think we're all kind of tired of the unintended consequences. I think
we're the ones who end up paying for them.
Right. And absolutely.
The other deal is that the County Police Department is authorized to operate in the unincorporated areas of the county, which is, you know, farmlands and hills, but the municipalities all have their own police departments. Now, are we going to get into jurisdictional disputes if, say, a county police vehicle passes an accident scene in, say, O'Fallon en route to visit to the hills? Will you stop and help, or, sorry, you'll have to wait for the O'Fallon Police Department to come?
Yeah, it totally muddies up the water on all kinds of levels.
Well, these are questions that really need to be asked and answered that have not been asked or answered, or in some cases, quite frankly, they have been asked, because I asked a number of them at the county council meeting on the 27th of August when I spoke against this requirement or this bill. But everything was sort of brushed off the edge of the table and onto the floor, and that was the end of that.
Right. Okay. In true culture vigilante style, we have Save Our Sheriff Department, that's DEPT.com. We've got a website up and running. Let's talk about how the folks can take matters into their own hands to fight this initiative at the ballot in November. What's going on? What can we expect to find there, Terry?
Well, I can expect to find some good information. Number one, when we look at the site, they have a good section called Get the Facts. They do have a Take Action. Volunteer, sign up for email notifications, a list of upcoming events that are taking place, resources, and, of course, the marvelous D word, donate.
Right.
And they do accept, in addition to Coin of the Realm, let's see. They do accept checks, tags, of course, and for $1, you can get a Save Our Sheriff's Department bumper sticker, or if you make a $5 or greater donation online, you'll get the bumper sticker free.
Okay. So bumper stickers are a fabulous way to start getting the word out about what's going on here. They're a great advertisement for the cause. People need to understand that these are sheriff's deputies who have come out of a comfort zone to try to advocate to save their sheriff's department because it's the right thing to do for St. Charles County. They're not political activists, so we need all of the citizens to get actively engaged in this situation and go to the website. They will have, I think they do actually have door hangers available.
20,000 door hangers are coming in addition to the bumper stickers, and the next item in line are yard signs.
Okay.
Also very effective.
So we need boots on the ground. We need people to get actively engaged in their neighborhoods and go to this website, get some door hangers and yard signs, and walk your neighborhoods and put this information out there, because the average independent voter is not engaged in what's going on in their community, and we need to educate them. We need their vote to be able to save their sheriff's department and protect their law enforcement protection here in the county. So
well, here, something to just be aware of. Let me read to you the charter question that is going to be on the ballot, all right? Because if you're not familiar with all that's going on, then you may be misled by this. So this is what it says. Shall the St. Charles County Charter be amended by providing for the establishment of a county police department and transferring the duties for the patrol division, detective bureau, and other direct police duties and their support functions to a county police department, and providing for the sheriff's department to be in charge of court services and security, including prisoner transport, service of process, and bailiff and other court security duties, yes or no? And that's all it says. But it's a lot like an iceberg, Lisa. What is revealed above the waterline is interesting, but what resides below that waterline is significant.
Absolutely. So the people can go to SaveOurSheriffDepartment.com. There are PDF flyers available online for you to print out as well if you want to hand information out to your neighbors. That'll give them a little bit more detail about what's going on with this charter and this ballot initiative. You can get yard signs, you can get door hangers, you can get bumper stickers, and donations, folks, more than anything else. We're doing this on the fly here and scraping together things as we can. If you can't do anything else, please send them a couple of bucks because they need the money. They're working hard to save your law enforcement situation here in St. Charles County. Thank you, Terry, for being with us. We really appreciate your time today. We hope that you'll be able to come back next week and give us another update. Hopefully we'll have a lot of volunteers between then and now who have come up with who've been able to help the situation along. Also, I want to tell you, there will be some information on this website about a write-in campaign. We're going to put all the information up there where you can write the county council, you can write the county executive, the sheriff, the newspapers, to kind of help spread that word and to let the folks in elected office know that you do not support this initiative.
Absolutely correct, Lisa. And it's a pleasure, as always, to chat with you and the your listeners.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again next week, Terry.
Okay,
that wraps it up for us tonight. We've run really long. Thanks for staying with us. And join us here again next week. We will follow up on some of the things that we talked about tonight and hopefully have some more good information for you on the Todd Akin campaign. And don't forget to join Dave on Monday night, Hour of Truth, and Kevin tomorrow night, Kevin Harned, Mr. Hillbilly Logic, and we'll be here on Friday night with the Missouri Grassroots Roundtable. Until then, we'll see you next time.